Chapter 10. "You want Mr. Herriot? Certainly, I'll get him for you." Siegfried cut the phone with his hand. "Come on, James. Here's another one prefers you to me." I glanced at him quickly, but he was smiling. He was pleased. I thought, as I took the phone, of the tales I'd heard of the other kind of boss, the man who couldn't bear to be knocked off his little pedestal, and I thought, too, of the difference a few weeks had made in the farmer's attitude. They didn't look past me now, hoping that Mr. Farnan had come with me. They were beginning to accept me, and I like to think that it wasn't only their hospitable traditions that made them ask me in for a bit of dinner. This really meant something, because with the passage of time, an appreciation of the Dales people had grown in me, a sense of the value of their carefully given friendship. The higher up the country, the more I liked them. At the bottom of the valley, where it widened into the plain, the farmers were like farmers everywhere. But the people grew more interesting as the land heightened, and in the scattered hamlets and isolated farms near the bleak tops, I found their characteristics most marked. Their simplicity and dignity, their rugged independence, and their hospitality. This Sunday morning it was the Bellabys, and they lived at the top of Holden, a little valley branching off the main dale. My car bumped and rattled over the last rough mile of an earth road, with the tops of boulders sticking up every few yards. I got out, and from where I stood high at the head, I could see all of the strangely formed cleft in the hills, its steep sides grooved and furrowed by countless streams feeding the boisterous Holden Beck, which tumbled over its rocky bed far below. Down there were trees and some cultivated fields, but immediately behind me the wild country came crowding in on the bowl where the farmhouse lay. Holston Pike, Alfdang, Burnside. The huge fells with their barbarous names were very near. Up here the trappings of civilization seemed far away. The farm buildings had been built massively of stone hundreds of years ago with the simple object of sheltering the animals. Those ancient masons were untroubled by regulations about the light and ventilation, and the cow byre was gloomy, thick-walled, almost windowless. The floor was broken and pitted, and rotting wooden partitions separated the cows from each other. I went in, groping my way until my eyes grew accustomed to the dim light. There was nobody there, but a roan cow had a label tied to its tail. Since this was a common way of communicating with the vet, I lifted the tail and read, "Felon, back quarters." I pushed the cow over and began to examine the back teats. I was drawing out the stringy, discoloured milk when a voice addressed me from the doorway.
"Oh, it's you, Mr. Elliot. I'm right glad you've come to see us this morning. You could do us such a great favour if you would."
I looked up and saw Ruth Bellaby, a fine-looking woman in her late 30s. She was the go-ahead member of the family and had an intelligent, questing mind. She was a great believer in self-improvement for the Dales people.
"Well, I'll be glad to help you if I can, Miss Bellaby.
What is it you'd like me to do?"
"Well, Mr. Elliot, you know they are putting on the Messiah at Dalaby Church this afternoon, and we did badly want to go, but it's such a job getting the pony and trap ready, and it's so slow. If you could give us a lift down in your car, I know we'd be able to get a ride back. It would be such a help."
"Of course I'll run you down," I replied.
"I'll be delighted to do it. I'm going myself, as a matter of fact. You don't get many chances to hear good music in Dalaby."
It was good to have a chance to help these kindly people. I'd always marvelled at the Bellabys. They seemed to me to be survivors from another age, and their world had a timeless quality. They were never in a hurry. They rose when it was light, went to bed when they were tired, ate when they were hungry, and seldom looked at a clock. Ruth led the way over to the house.
"There's just Mother and Dad and me going. Bob's not interested, I'm afraid."
I was slightly taken aback when I entered the house. The family were just sitting down to Sunday dinner, and were still in their working clothes. I stole a look at my watch. 11:45, and the performance started at 2 p.m. Oh well, I probably had plenty of time.
"Come on, young man," said little Mr. Bellaby. "Sit down and have a bit of dinner."
It was always a bit tricky refusing these invitations without causing offence, but I pointed out that my own meal would be ready when I got back, and it would be hard on Mrs. Hall if it were wasted. They were quick to appreciate this argument and settled down round the scrubbed kitchen table. Mrs. Bellaby served a large, round Yorkshire pudding to each of them, and poured a pool of gravy into it from a quart-size enamel jug. I'd had a hard morning, and the delicious scent that rose from the gravy as it ran over the golden slabs was a sweet torture. But I consoled myself with the thought that the fact of my sitting there would make them hurry. The pudding was consumed in leisurely silence. Then Bob, an amiable, thick-set youth in his 20s, pushed out his empty plate. He did not say anything, but his mother planked down another pudding on the plate and plied the gravy jug again. His parents and sister watched him benevolently as he methodically demolished the thick, doughy mass. Next, a tremendous roast appeared from the oven, and Mr. Bellaby hacked and sawed at it till they all had a heap of thick slices on their plates. Then mountains of mashed potatoes were served from something that looked like a washing-up bowl. Chopped turnip followed, and the family went into action again. There was no sign of haste. They ate calmly and quietly without any small talk. Bob had an extra helping of mashed potatoes.